Welcome to Your New Mexico Government. I'm your host, Khalil A. Colonna. Today we ask, is the response to COVID-19 colorblind? We already have the answer, no. More black and brown communities are being struck by the virus at alarming rates around the country. Today we talk with health experts and leaders about how and why COVID-19 is wreaking havoc along racial lines. It's not easy to sit with, but my advice for you is, rather than becoming angry about the situation, be prepared to become enlightened so you can do something about it. First up, executive producer Marisa DeMarco has a news rundown of what we know today, Thursday, April 16th, as of 5 p.m.
22 million people filed for unemployment in the last month, and a top economist, Joseph Stiglitz, tells the New York Times that the economy as it was had, quote, no shock absorbers. It maximized profits but had much bigger risks and low resiliency, he explained. Basically, he said, lots of people had jobs but still couldn't afford the basics, according to data. Their work schedules and pay were not predictable, and 4 in 10 people didn't have enough in the bank to cover an unplanned $400 expense. And the pandemic has exposed the real precarity of this. President Trump today said it's up to governors to decide when to reopen their states and issued some loose guidelines. It's a switch from his position last week when he was saying he had total authority to decide about ending the shutdowns. Governor Michelle Lujan Grisham said in a news release that it's not safe to reopen New Mexico yet, and it would undo the work a lot of healthcare responders are doing. There were 8 deaths from the virus in New Mexico today, and that's the most that's happened on one day in the state. The death toll for New Mexico stands at 44, and almost 1,600 people are confirmed to have the virus. Navajo Nation President Jonathan Nez told Your New Mexico Government this afternoon that the Navajo Nation has seen 38 deaths and 921 cases. He commended the first responders there and said if people weren't sticking with social distancing, those numbers would be much worse. He said of nearly 5,000 COVID tests they've done, a little more than 3,200 came back negative. His office also issued a news release today opposing federal money for tribes going to corporations. Educators from around New Mexico are submitting a formal request asking that the state's Educational Retirement Board divest from private prison corporations, CoreCivic, and the GEO Group, according to a news release, saying those companies are running death traps for asylum seekers because of this pandemic and the potential for an outbreak in ICE detention facilities. For Your New Mexico Government, I'm Marisa DeMarco.
For an understanding of how COVID-19 is impacting the Native community, I'm on the line with Navajo Nation President Jonathan Nez. President Nez, thank you for joining me today.
Well, thank you, Khalil, for having me on the show, and I appreciate your listeners tuning in today and just giving them a glimpse of what's happening on the Navajo Nation and a glimpse of what is transpiring throughout Indian country in sole response from the federal government. But, you know, we are a resilient people, and we're doing everything we can in our power and our own resources to get the help our citizens need.
Let me ask you about the federal government. The U.S. federal government authorized billions for tribes to fight the virus and its effects, but there were bureaucratic hurdles into getting that money. What were those problems?
Well, they're using the same process that is in place for any appropriation that comes from Congress. The tribes have a special relationship with the federal government through our treaties and those promises that were made during the time our ancestors, our leaders of the past, put their name on. Mm-hmm. And to this day, there have been some broken promises from the Navajo Nation. We have, a Navajo people, we have contributed greatly to this country. But I think with you having us on the show, it's going to shed some light on the red tape that's out there. And I'm hoping that our congressional delegation, as well as the White House, is listening in so that we can fix some of these barriers to get funding directly to the tribes. It's an emergency. Yeah. You know, it's a public health emergency here on the Navajo Nation. But, you know, we have to write grants and funding that gets appropriated. It's passed through federal programs like the CDC and other federal programs, the BIA, the IHS, and the states. Right now, the nation just don't have time to apply and send documents up there, wait for an award letter, the process to get the money. There's a dire need in Indian country right now. And so it should be a quick allocation to tribes, not through federal programs.
Yeah.
And we've been saying that for many years now. Tribal leaders have been saying it shouldn't be a pass-through. It should be direct appropriation directly to the tribal government. But don't get me wrong. There's monies going to the Navajo area IHS, a great team there. I want to give them a shout out. But IHS overall has been underfunded. Mm. We don't have the best healthcare system in tribal communities. This should be a wake-up call for all of us leaders to make those changes and get dollars to help our healthcare industry, not lobbyists, not these companies, but for the people and those healthcare service providers clear across the country. So it's not just a Navajo or Indian issue. Of course, we have some problems. Yes, we want to highlight those. But clear across the country, I think it just shows that pandemic like this, we're not equipped for.
Let me finish by asking you, what about moving forward? What are the plans? What are you looking at now to continue to flatten the curve within the Navajo Nation and some ideas about for the future?
We're going to utilize the tools that are at our disposal. And that also includes laws and health orders that we can do as a sovereign nation. We're doing everything we can to slow down and stop the spread, even though little to none federal resources are coming in.
Well, I really hope that you all get those resources very, very soon. He is Navajo Nation President Jonathan Nez. Thank you and my best wishes to you.
Thank you, Khalil, and thank you all your listeners. God bless.
To further understand the impact of COVID-19 on the African-American community, I'm on the line with Dr. Suzette McKinney. She's the CEO of the Illinois Medical District and adjunct instructor at Harvard's T.H. Chan School of Public Health. Dr. McKinney, thank you so much for being on the show.
Thank you so much for having me, Khalil. It's my pleasure.
So how you holding up?
You know, I'm holding up pretty good. Things here in the state of Illinois are very busy, but we are making progress. We just want to make sure that we are prepared for additional capacity if we need it.
Yes, I'm glad that you all are doing that. They're taking similar measures here in New Mexico. And let me ask you this. Why does COVID-19 have such a great effect on the Black community? And you know, what can be done about this?
Well, first and foremost, I think one of the challenges is that the Black community suffers disproportionately from healthcare disparities for a number of different conditions. Those conditions typically are chronic health conditions such as diabetes, heart disease, hypertension, and then also asthma. Mm. And so I think when you overlay COVID-19 on top of some of those chronic conditions, underlying conditions, it makes for more serious illness. But I think when we start to discuss what can we do to overcome it, we can't have that discussion without talking about the social determinants of health and things that created the environments that caused Blacks to have such disproportionately high health disparities.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Things like housing inequality, income inequality, healthcare inequality, as well as educational inequality. So when we start to consider how to overcome those issues, it's not about overcoming them just for COVID-19. It's about a more comprehensive, all-encompassing strategy to overcome them.
I would include access to quality food as well in that.
Absolutely.
That's been a conversation that friends and I have been having for years about the lack of quality food. As far as information, why does the need for information need to be disseminated very differently in underserved communities?
First of all, I think about the African-American community, the Black community in particular. There are long-standing perceptions of the intentions behind healthcare and government and the impact to the Black community when government is involved in healthcare and when healthcare is developing new medical interventions. You know, we've all heard about the Tuskegee experiments.
Yes.
And so I think for that reason, there is continues to be significant mistrust of the government among the most vulnerable communities, particularly the Black community.
With that in mind, what can public health agencies do differently in Black and underserved communities to really begin to build that bridge of trust?
One of the things that public health can do, and where I think we haven't done the best job, is in building the community preparedness capability for emergencies such as COVID-19. There has to be an active engagement of community members themselves, residents, whether that takes the form of a community council where you have residents of a community that you meet, that public health meets with regularly, mm-hmm. to help ensure that information about the planning that's happening, the response as how it would be launched, and also the basic things that those communities need to know in order to protect themselves, even if just for a short period of time, while the government and the associated response entities get their acts together, if you will.
Yes, yes. And getting their act together is a key phrase. I saw a video last night of the mayor from West Memphis who is telling people to stay there. This is on radio. He's told them to stay their butts at home. he didn't use the word butts, but I felt like that was an effective message that would get through to people. And speaking about messages, COVID-19, how is this going to change our dialogue around the country about healthcare and how it affects underserved communities? What can be done in the national dialogue, and how do you think that will take place?
Well, I certainly hope that what happens as a result of COVID-19 is that we begin to pay greater attention to those things that have created the disparities, that have made communities more vulnerable, and begin to address those issues head on. So what I hope is that we continue to see the mobilization of multiple partners, the private business sector, nonprofits, philanthropic organizations, as well as healthcare, government, and the like, coming together to identify solutions to these challenges once and for all, so that those challenges are not magnified when we're involved in an emergency event such as COVID-19 or even some sort of large scale natural disaster or other type of emergency.
We are all in this together, but I think human beings are beginning to realize that, not just in New Mexico, Chicago, and the United States, but across the globe. Dr. Suzette McKinney, CEO at the Illinois Medical District, thank you so much for being with me.
Thank you for having me.
And even though race and ethnicity data isn't kept in New Mexico's criminal justice system, it's fair to say that there are a lot of Black and brown people locked up out of proportion with what the percentage of the population they make up. With me now to explain the dangers COVID-19 presents to people in jails and prisons is Bennett Barr, Chief Public Defender for the state of New Mexico. Bennett, thanks for being with me today.
Thank you, sir, for having me.
More than a week ago, the governor ordered the Corrections Department to release people from prison who have 30 days left on their sentence, who are nonviolent offenders. But Jeff Proctor reports for New Mexico In Depth that only 14 people have been released. And a report from the Sentencing Commission shows that there could be 300 people who are eligible. Preventing an outbreak is very, very urgent. So tell me, what is the holdup?
The holdup is that there is a fear of the politics. And it's because of that holdup and because of the fact that there's been only 14 people released so far, which really would statistically do nothing to address the public health crisis in the prisons, that we filed a petition for a writ with the state Supreme Court to ask them to order the Department of Corrections to address the release in a much more systemic way.
What type of prisoners would be released?
There's a broad range of people that should be considered, and that would be people who had been on probation or parole and had committed what they call technical violations. These are things like having a positive drug test or failing to appear to meet with their officer, and they were violated and put into prison because of that and not because they had committed a new crime. There's a lot of people who are in there on nonviolent offenses, some of them only on drug offenses. And what we know is that there's a group of people, and I think it's a pretty large group, that could be released and would not only not be a threat to public safety because of what actions they would take, but we have to think about public health as a component of public safety. And if we actually create a public health crisis in our jails or prisons, and that leaves the jails and prisons, comes out into the greater community, we're actually creating a greater threat to public safety by not releasing people.
And jails and prisons, these are like perfect incubators.
And it's not just for people that are incarcerated there, but again, it's for the staff, for the health workers that are in there who come in and go home to their families. A lot of these people are not tested other than taking their temperature and asking them a series of questions. And we know that people can be carriers of the virus without being symptomatic. So I think it's only a matter of time before this problem gets a lot worse if we don't do something.
I mean, exactly what are you all asking the Supreme Court to do?
What we're asking them to do, and what we actually would like to do ourselves, is talk to the Department of Corrections and any other interested actors here, district attorneys, the Attorney General's office, and find a procedure that we can use together to address this problem.
Now, finally, do you see these efforts to let nonviolent people in jeopardy of catching the deadly virus out of prisons and jails as a part of the conversation on systemic racism and the criminal justice system?
I think it has to be. One of the things that this coronavirus pandemic has shown us in the criminal justice system is really the underlying racial disparities. As public defenders, we see it all the time. The number of people of color that are in our system because they are from underserved communities, because there's untreated mental illness and substance abuse issues that are at the root of their actions that got them there in the first place, it becomes obvious now as we're looking at who we need to release for their benefit and the benefit of the community. Those are the people that are still in the facilities. Those are the people that we need to get released for their safety and for the safety of their entire community.
The issue of systemic racism has been ignored way too long, and the longer this goes, it's going to be harder for us to turn a blind eye to it. I want to thank you for being on the show, and thank you for your work.
Thank you, sir.
This is Your NM Government. I'm your host, Khalil A. Colonna. Every weekday, we're covering the way the virus and health measures are impacting people differently around the state. Stay tuned in weeknights at 7:30 p.m. Dr. Felicia Rohan Minhares is an assistant dean of clinical education and a practicing family physician whose primary COVID-related work is as the co-director of a new course created for second and third year medical students called COVID-19 in 2020. I'd like to welcome her to the show. Dr. Rohan Minhares, thank you for joining me.
Thank you for the invitation. It's a pleasure to be here.
Can I ask you, we're seeing racial disparities in data about COVID-19 infections and deaths. As someone who has studied the social determinants of health, what are the factors here in New Mexico that people may not be considering when they hear this?
As we keep seeing the numbers come out about the high rates of COVID and COVID-related illness in our Native American and Latino populations, as well as other communities of color, we recognize that socioeconomics play a factor. Access to clean water plays a significant factor, especially thinking of the impact on our Native American population. Mm-hmm. Ability to social distance. So social distance is actually being discussed as a privilege, right? So in order to be able to socially distance, one of the factors is being able to have a job that allows you to work from home.
Yeah.
We know that many of the people working on the front lines here in New Mexico are people who already have a disproportionate burden of disease when it comes to things like diabetes, coronary artery disease, asthma, and also happen to have jobs that require that they continue to work on the front lines, our grocery store workers, for example.
Mm-hmm. I've noted that we talked yesterday with people who are on the front lines working, and many of them are in similar situations. You've done trainings on racial bias for medical students because there's a long acknowledged problem where doctors and nurses sometimes give the wrong diagnosis or treatment because of this bias. Are you worried about how that may be playing out during the pandemic?
We know that under times of stress, under times of time pressure, these implicit biases tend to emerge and can actually impact the care that's delivered to patients. Fortunately, in New Mexico, I'm constantly and very regularly hearing how clinicians are thinking about these problems. I think that there's real awareness of the racial disparities, and I think clinicians are thinking about this in their approach to patient care. I think we've been really fortunate at UNM School of Medicine to include this training for the last 10 years in curriculum, and I think it has an effect that permeates throughout UNM Hospital.
Yes, and this has been going on for generations, but some people are not very aware of this. How does unconscious bias play a role in the treatment of diverse patients?
A good way to think about it is having two patients side by side. Say we have two 65-year-old women presenting with fever, cough, shortness of breath. One of them happens to be white, one of them happens to be black. With the same clinical presentation and with the same demographic besides some skin color, our hope is that both of them would get the same treatment in a system that's set up to provide equitable care. I think in our current environment in New Mexico, I think both of those women are getting the testing and the care that they need. Now, when systems become more stressed and more resource scarce, then I think that's when I worry that implicit bias may have increased impact on the decisions that clinicians are made on the front line.
Now, what advice do you have for doctors and nurses treating COVID patients in urgent or impossibly bad conditions for making sure that they're able to think around any possible biases they may have in the moment?
The very first step is acknowledging that implicit biases exist. All of us have these implicit biases. All of us must grapple with the fact that they're part of the way our brains work. For these doctors and nurses and many, many healthcare providers that are on the front lines, this is the time where it's really important for every single encounter that we step into with the patient, we make a personal commitment to provide the highest level of care that is equitable between patients. That might require slowing down. That might require making sure to ask all the questions that you would normally ask. It also means checking in. If you're feeling frustrated or uncomfortable, those are signs that sometimes implicit bias is sneaking in. So if you're feeling the frustration, if you're feeling discomfort, that might be a time to check in with yourself mentally and kind of instinctively and slow down to make sure that your best skills as a clinician and your best intention of providing equitable care are at the forefront of the way you're conducting your work that day.
Yeah. Now, are we seeing racism play out within the systems that already exist more pointedly during the pandemic?
Absolutely. We're seeing the impact of decades of structural racism play out. We're seeing the highest rates of death in New York City being in the Latino community. In Illinois, African Americans make up about 15% of the population. 42% of the deaths in their COVID patients have been in African Americans. There's a lot of discussion about how individual behavior plays into this. The broader discussion is honestly about structural factors, structural racism, structural vulnerabilities that have been present in our society for decades now that we have to start addressing.
This is something we cannot hide from. I want to thank you so much. She's Dr. Felicia Rohan Minhades, Assistant Dean of Clinical Education and Practicing Family Physician. Thank you so much for joining me today.
Thank you all so much. Be safe.
I'm on the line with Bing Hong. He's the media and PR specialist for the Asian Family Center. Bing, thank you very much for being with me today.
Thank you very much for inviting me.
Now, tell me, there's been a few racist incidents that have happened over the past few weeks and months. One where a person was attacked at Costco, another in the form of a prank at the University of New Mexico. Can you tell me what you know about those incidents?
I worked pretty closely with the racist prank happened on a Chinese international student back at UNM dorm, I would say about 1 month ago. I think he filed a police report based on that. We also helped him to figure out whether there's other place he can stay. Actually, we checked with him a couple of days ago. You know what? He donated 1,000 pieces of, you know, mask to us and want us to, you know, redirect those donations to the people who need those. We donate everything to a local hospital.
Have people been coming to the Asian Family Center with complaints?
We have concerns. We have concerns. And basically, Asian communities has, you know, fears as well. So we got some of this conversation ongoing, yes.
Yeah. What type of things are they saying? What are their concerns?
The concerns, basically, the whole COVID-19 being called as a Chinese virus. And also a lot of online discourse regarding on how Asian should take responsibilities on this one, which is totally unfair.
When the president calls these things the Chinese virus and he sends out these racist messages, how is that kind of rhetoric and language damaging?
Oh, a lot. I would say a lot. I mean, the first thing that people got fear, like, you know, especially the Chinese American and Chinese community here. As a result, it's not only targeting the Chinese American or Chinese, it's targeting basically all Asians, just in different forms.
And speak on that. Speak on the diversity that is within the Asian community here in New Mexico.
And so basically, Albuquerque and New Mexico has acquired a lot of, you know, Asian Americans and Asians living here. The biggest population actually are Vietnamese, Chinese, Filipino, and Korean, Japanese, and we have a quite big, you know, refugee community here as well.
Has the Asian Family Center spoken with city officials about their concerns?
We do, actually. We're going to have a meeting later today with the City Council Lan Santa. She's a Vietnamese American who just recently got elected. And we're going to talk with her on some of the concerns we have and to see how the city can support Asian community. And basically, we hope we can get more support from the city, especially on the language access, so we can deliver the information more immediately and more on time to the community, especially those who have language barriers.
How are members of the Asian community able to maintain and hold on to hope in the face of these times?
Different people definitely have different strategies on this one. What I am doing and what I am doing with a group of people right now is that we use action against this kind of, you know, comments and this stuff. So me and a group of, you know, Chinese American, we form a small, kind of like a loose organization. We're trying to raise monies from the community and purchase PPEs, especially masks, you know, and give them to the local hospital and clinics and the first responders. We're just trying to do what can help our community and especially the medical workers out.
I definitely agree. And that's good work that you're doing. Can you have solidarity from me?
We realize it's like, you know, we have to fight this as one community. It's the COVID-19 or the racism and everything. We have to fight them as a whole community. I'll say majority of the people, majority of the community gave us support. And yeah, so that's the motivation why we keep doing what we're doing right now. Mm-hmm.
Thank you. Thank you again for coming on to the show. He is Bing Hong, media and PR specialist for the Asian and Family Center. I'll be talking with you soon, my friend.
Thank you very much. I'll see you soon.
You can find a full list of the resources we talk about on each episode and opportunities to donate or help online at bit.ly/YNMGHub. For more information on the Asian Family Center, head to their website, nmafc.org. They're redesigning the site, but they have contact information there for all types of inquiries. Or you can find them on Facebook. For more information on mistreatment in medical care situations, call UNM's Health Sciences Learning Environment Office, 505-272-7861. You can always check out our post here on this episode on KUNM.org for a direct link. To see how you can offer help to the Navajo Nation, go to Navajo-NSN.gov. You will want to tune in tomorrow when we take a chill pill. Not actually, but tomorrow, executive producer Marisa DeMarco and I talk about what we both have learned in the somehow short but long month of covering the COVID-19 pandemic. We even talk about how we are affected by it, and we'll give you updates on many of the big stories we've been tackling day to day. Tomorrow, we open up. YNMG at 7:30 p.m. Your New Mexico Government is executive produced by Marisa DeMarco. It's produced by yours truly. News update by Marisa DeMarco. Many thanks to the team at KUNM. Big ups to Ty Bannerman for putting in the editing work. It's like Game of Thrones. You make a call for help and your Bannermen show up. Ha ha. Theme music by Pope Yes Yes Y'all. Hear us all week long on KUNM's airwaves at 7:30 p.m. Online, find the show on KUNM.org or subscribe through iTunes, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts. Your New Mexico Government is a collaboration between KUNM, New Mexico PBS, and the Santa Fe Reporter. Funding for our coverage is provided in part by the Thornburg Foundation, the W.K. Kellogg Foundation, the New Mexico Local News Fund, and KUNM listeners like you. For everyone here at Your New Mexico Government, I'm Khalil A. Colonna. Thanks for listening.